This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
More than 25 years after civil war ended in Somaliland, researchers continue to unearth mass graves. Forensic investigators hope to gather enough evidence to bring the alleged perpetrators of war crimes to justice. So far, two cases have gone to U.S. courts.
That's Jason Patinkin reporting from the Somaliland town of Barbara. Details coming up.
Also, the World Food Program has begun delivering food by air to drought-stricken South Sudan. And Zimbabwe is marking 2 years since the disappearance of activist Itai Dzamara.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the international aid agency World Food Program has begun delivering food by air to South Sudan. It's been hard hit by the same drought that has also pushed Somalia into a food crisis. Civil war in South Sudan is exacerbating the problem, with tens of thousands of people facing famine. Reuters news agency quotes a WFP team leader in Leer town as saying they are delivering 259 metric tons of food, including cereal, vegetable oil, and a corn-soya blend specially made for children to combat malnutrition. The WFP expects to help more than 4 million people this year in South Sudan. The United Nations has declared parts of South Sudan as famine-stricken, meaning at least a fifth of the households are facing extreme food shortages. The WFP says it has supplied about 14,000 people in South Sudan with enough food aid to last about a month.
More than 25 years after civil war ended in Somaliland, researchers continue to unearth mass graves. Forensic investigators hope to gather enough evidence to bring the alleged perpetrators of war crimes to justice. So far, two cases have gone to U.S. courts. Jason Patinkin reports from the Somaliland town of Barbara.
Using metal hand tools, a team of forensic investigators scrapes away soil covering a mass grave in the town of Berbera, Somaliland. Nearly 2 meters below are the bodies of 17 men who are believed to have been rounded up, shot, and dumped here nearly 30 years ago. The men are from the Isak clan. They were allegedly killed by troops loyal to Somali dictator Siad Barre, who was battling rebels from Somaliland. The campaign killed about 50,000 people, mostly from the Isak clan. Somaliland declared independence after the Barre regime collapsed in 1991, but the breakaway republic remains unrecognized internationally. Khadar Ahmed Like, chair of Somaliland's War Crimes Investigations Commission, says they will gather evidence and then rebury the remains.
Every person has the right to be buried in his religious method. So we are just taking out these bodies and we are burying them separately after cleaning and praying on them.
As the team digs lower, they use shovels and pickaxes to remove the dirt. After days of work, they reach the bodies. A skull wrapped in cloth pokes out of the dirt. Dozens more mass graves like this one dot Somaliland's landscape. The commission says this was a genocide, though the use of the term is disputed. This mass grave in Berbera is the 11th the commission has opened in the last 5 years. After removing the bones, the team reassemble the skeletons and analyze the remains in hopes of identifying them. Back in the lab, Valeska Martinez, a forensic analyst from Chile, shows how one skull has been deeply shattered, indicating a probable cause of death.
Mostly of the case is gunshot wound in the head or in the thoracic area. If we see like a gunshot wound in the head, we know that this person don't die in a natural way. With that kind of proof, we can show in the court a proof that this person was murdered.
But the exhumations are divisive. Fights broke out between family members and police as relatives of the victims tried to block the opening of this grave. The commission did not consult the families about the process first. Khadra Mohammed Abdi, whose father was in the mass grave, says she wants his killer found and jailed, but she was against removing his body.
It's also painful. You know, someone you forgot 25 years ago, and then when we see the process, it's new to us. All the time, you know, we were crying because we remember what happened that time. We told them not to dig.
Commissioner Leekade dismissed the family's concerns. He says proving the atrocities took place is of national importance and could even lead to international recognition of Somaliland.
Actually, for them, it's nothing, but it is for us to prove that this genocide has occurred by the regime of Siad Barre.
Digging up the past brings no easy answers. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Berbera, Somaliland.
Zimbabwe is marking 2 years since the disappearance of activist Itai Zamara. Activists and family members gathered in the capital to renew pressure on authorities to investigate his abduction. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
Pro-democracy activists commemorate the two-year anniversary of the disappearance of one of their own, Itai Zamara. Zamara was an outspoken critic of President Robert Mugabe, and he organized anti-government demonstrations. He was last seen in 2015 being loaded into a car by men believed to be plainclothes officers of the Central Intelligence Organization. Zamara was about to have his hair cut, and his barber and several bystanders say they witnessed the incident. His wife, Shefra, attended Thursday's event.
She
says it is painful that it is now 2 years and Itai has not been found. The police and the government, they do not respect us at all. She says police could track the culprits if they wanted. On Thursday, the U.S. Embassy in Harare and the European Union mission issued separate statements expressing deep concern about the lack of progress in the Zamara case. Before Thursday's commemoration, police tried to block the event but later gave in to threats of a lawsuit from Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights. The event drew about 200 people who gathered at the Freedom Square in the capital. Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa has rebuffed accusations the government is dragging its feet in the investigation. So has the police spokeswoman Cherry Jaramba.
The ZRP is pursuing all possible avenues to locate Itai Kadiki Zamara, as directed by Justice Mangota. The Minister of Home Affairs, Minister of State Security, human rights lawyers and Zamara's relatives are also actively involved in the investigation with the police. Periodical meetings are being held with all concerned parties with a view to establish the whereabouts of Itai Kadiki Zamara.
On Thursday, Zamara's relatives disputed that claim. They said the police are not complying with the High Court ruling in which Justice David Mangota ordered state security agents to regularly update Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights on progress in the case. Last year, Amnesty International appealed to set up a commission of inquiry on Zamara's disappearance, but the proposal appears to have fallen on deaf ears. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Libya's Eastern Parliament voted to end its approval for the UN peace deal and the Government of National Accord. The breakaway militias, backed by Western Libyan factions, managed to seize oil terminals from General Haftar's Libyan National Army. Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi about whether these developments could lead to more violence and would shake the power balance in Libya.
Yes, it's very likely that the HOR withdrawing its approval of the Libyan political agreement will lead to greater escalation of conflict and a vision within Libya. That's because this peace process framework, which has been brokered by the UN and regional powers, is really the only route currently open for negotiation between the different competing factions. So without this, really the only way of interaction is through conflict and violence.
The breakaway militias, backed by Western Libyan factions, managed to seize oil terminals from General Haftar's forces. Would that shake his power?
Yes, I think this actually marks a significant shift in power within Libya. Now, it may be that Haftar and the Libyan National Army forces are able to retake the oil crescent port. However, the fact that the BDB has been able to get so far and take control of it really is undermines Haftar's image of being a strong man. Essentially, he is a strong man who is not so strong anymore. And it's likely that the way that Haftar was able to take the oil crescent ports back in September last year was through an alliance with local militias and tribal leaders. It now seems that the Benghazi Defense Brigade have turned this back on him and themselves have formed this alliance, therefore undermining Haftar's power base in that region. This doesn't mean that in the east of Libya, Haftar is suddenly going to lose his power, but it certainly significantly undermined his image of being able to take control of the whole of Libya.
The GNA said the oil terminals had been abandoned by the Benghazi Defense Brigades and they are now under GNA's control. Does that present a real shift in power balance in Libya?
It does, but perhaps not in the way you might imagine. Now, what has actually happened is that the Benghazi Defense Brigades have given over control to the GNA's head of the Petroleum Facilities Guard. However, this is not the BDB abandoning them and then another power taking control. The BDB have agreed to hand this over. And that is very significant because it is likely that the GNA in Tripoli is losing a lot of power. And therefore, it doesn't mean that because one of its forces is nominally in control of the oil crescent ports that it actually has control. And actually, this, what it really means is that the Benghazi Defense Brigade and their allies in Tripoli, which are the forces loyal to Khalifa al-Khoeil and his National Salvation Government, and also the Grand Mufti Sadiq al-Khariani, actually it's these powers that seem to be in the ascendancy, and this could actually lead to the GNA severely weakening in Tripoli and actually this sort of more Islamist alliance gaining greater power in relation to both the GNA and Haftar in the east.
But how do you explain the fast developments in Libya at a time Egyptian mediation sought to pave the road for a political solution?
I think it's actually because the Egyptian solution had been gaining some traction with Haftar and with other parties that this move has taken place. So the sort of Islamist coalition was very worried that a political deal involving Haftar would exclude them as the more extreme fringes of power. And therefore, they really didn't want that to happen. By undertaking this offensive, they've not only undermined Haftar's power, but they have meant that the likelihood of this political solution, as we are seeing, is unlikely to succeed, because there are now far more divisions and conflict going on the ground. Therefore, the conditions for negotiation are far worsened.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis. She was speaking with reporter Mohammed El-Shinawi.
Past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A new report highlights the need to involve indigenous and local communities in wildlife conservation. The recommendation is made in the Food and Agriculture Organization's latest quarterly forestry report. FAO senior forestry official Sheila Wirtz says local participation is essential because communities have a deep understanding of ecology, conservation, and management. She says effective community participation can improve local food security.
It does also connect to food security in the fact that local communities very often rely on wildlife for their protein intake. The value of wildlife for local food security is, for example, illustrated by the fact that in several Bantu languages, the word nyama, for example, refers to wildlife, but also to meat. And this just to say that sustainable wildlife management is essential for achieving food security in many countries, and this is the reason as well why FAO is working on these.
Wirt says communities can benefit from local wildlife through tourism. Another widely used method is trophy hunting, a practice criticized by some in the West as a form of poaching. But Wirt says, unlike poaching, trophy hunting is legal and, if well regulated, limits the numbers of animals killed. She says while the hunters may take parts of the animals as souvenirs, communities may keep most of the animal for food. Also, proceeds from hunters could be used to improve services like schools and health clinics. The FAO's report cautions groups that want to ban managed hunting, saying it removes incentives for communities to protect wildlife. In places like South Africa, it's brought success, including increasing the number of white rhino from 1,800 to 18,000 over several decades. Black rhinos have increased from 2,300 in 2004 to 3,900 today. The FAO and its partners are working to resolve such conflicts. It has introduced management manuals with practical solutions to common problems.
For example, in Gabon's Crystal Mountain National Park, the human-wildlife conflict was provoked by animals such as elephants who were destroying the entire crops of local communities and thereby threatening their food security. At the same time, these communities were preventing from taking any actions because the law prohibited them to hunt these animals. I mean, they were protected.
The management manuals recommend keeping elephants away from food crops by constructing fences around plantations, building small fires in nearby, and hiring guards to protect the crops. The FAO report says conservation models are being developed in Africa and the developing world.
In 2015, then-Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan banned female genital mutilation in the country, but the law has not been enough to stop the practice, which is common in Nigeria. Many people are not even aware the ban exists. Those opposed to FGM say more needs to be done to end it. Dixon Salami Adama has more from southern Nigeria.
A 2016 report by a UK-based charity organization said about 20 million women and girls in Nigeria have undergone female genital mutilation, which represents 10% of the global total. The report notes that many Nigerian girls are caught as infants, 16% before their first birthday and 82% before the age of 5. The consequences of female circumcision, according to a 2014 UN report, is that it can cause severe pain, infertility, infections, scarring, many complications during childbirth, including maternal and newborn deaths. It can also lead to psychological damage and, of course, the loss of sexual pleasure. In 2015, one of the final duties performed by the former president, Goodluck Jonathan, before handing over power to his successor, President Muhammadu Buhari, was the signing of the federal law banning female circumcision in the country after it was passed by the Senate. Since the ban, however, there is still considerable support for the practice in areas where it is deeply rooted. Many people in those communities cherish it and see it as a cultural practice that must be upheld, while so many others are not even aware of the ban. A resident of Inyofot community in Uyo, Akwa Ibom State, South Nigeria, said she was circumcised by her grandmother when she was a kid, noting that the practice is good because it prevents women from promiscuity.
The reason why they do circumcision for women is to prevent women from having sex every time. Like my own, my grandmother did me when I was small. Up to now, they still do it. The tradition is still going on. What they are using to do it is they will use boiled egg. They will touch the thing will come out by himself. When they come out, they will use scissors or sharp razor and cut it. They know the size and the normal, they will use it and cut. I'm encouraged some village to continue to do it because it's a good thing. If government said they should start doing it, I think it's the wrong idea.
Another resident of Itam in the local government area of Akwa Ibom State said she was circumcised by her mother-in-law when she was pregnant with her first child and that it was not painful.
It's not very painful, though. They use razor and thread, and they cut me and use this hot, but it's finished. as the government say, women should not do that tradition again. But I like women to do it. Some women, they come to me and ask me, how do you do your own? And I tell them, say, look, when my mother-in-law do me this, it's not very painful. They ask me to do it for them. I say, I can't do it. They will go to the native women that used to hold people to born.
Reacting, the matron in charge of the Family Life Center and Maternal Birth Injury Hospital, Reverend Sister Sylvia Ndubaku, said female circumcision causes difficulty during delivery and that it does not reduce flatting among women as believed.
There are some cultural practices that are harmful, and I think our duty is to educate people to desist from such practice, like female circumcision. It traumatizes the girl. It creates a situation that a girl will have it very difficult during labor because everything is crept out during female circumcision. When the circumcision is healed, the scar it creates there is what causes the difficulty for a woman during delivery. And for me, I don't think it's necessary at this day and age to say if a woman is not circumcised, the woman will be flexing. I don't believe in that. There are women that are circumcised and yet they are flexing. The most important thing is the moral, what you believe in and the upbringing.
Barrister Clifford Thomas, who championed the campaign against female circumcision, is the Akwa Ibom State Chairman of Civil Liberties Organization and the State Coordinator of Human Rights Community. He said winning the battle against the practice will require an integrated engagement of custodians of people's culture because people place more value on their culture than any state law.
The issue of female genital mutilation is one thing we've always campaigned seriously against, even though governments generally in Nigeria have made efforts to ensure that this practice is stopped. When the government put up the law, it was a mere policy, if I would put it that way. But policies don't work on their own. Policies work with the people, for the people, and within the people. When people practice a particular set of ideas over time, it becomes convention. And if the root of that convention is culture, it is difficult for you to uproot it, except you put setting frameworks in place that first affects the custodians of the culture and then goes ahead to influence the practice of that culture before you bring in the law.
So the situation on ground as it is now is in different facets. The government has banned the practice, the locals still cherish the practice and wants it to continue, while many of them are not even aware of the ban, and the experts or campaigners are advocating for sensitization to illuminate the dangers of the practice. For VOA, this is Dixon Salami Adama reporting from Uyo, South Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned to the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.